My name is Meredith. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. What to say about our speaker? Our speaker this evening, I have known since about 2015 when she came in. I had maybe a little over a year, something like that, and she asked me to sponsor. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And, you know, it took her several years to get it, but I knew that when I saw her come back, and I knew how broken she was when she got back, one of the second times she came in, that she really wanted it, and she was really gonna give it everything she had. And so we've become friends now, and our kids know each other. It's just, our relationship is wonderful, and she is an amazing individual who has overcome so many things that I am really, really excited to introduce you to our very own Kelly H.
Hey everybody, I'm Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. Oh yeah, 2015 was the first time I came to Ridgeview. I started trying to get sober when I was 18 years old. I'm 39 right now. My sobriety date is October 8th, 2018. So tomorrow, thank you. So God willing, tomorrow I'll have 4 years, which is crazy to me. And to be invited to come here and tell my story is just, it's absolutely crazy where my life has gone in the last 4 years. Meredith is my sponsor. I don't like a lot of stuff she tells me to do. She has taken my hand and placed it in God's hand, and I'm so grateful for that. In this room tonight, so I live an hour and 34 minutes this evening is what it took me to get here. So I live far away from here, and this front row right here is some guys from my home group who came to support me. Over here, I have a sponsee, really good friend, friends all in the room, Jess back there. Jean was my roommate in sober living. So like when chaos was chaos, we were chaotic together. We still call each other regularly. I mean, it's just crazy standing here tonight. And so I'm trying to take it all in. So again, my name's Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's October 8, 2018. My home group is the primary purpose group in Noonan. I have a sponsor. I have a grand sponsor who's also here. See, I'm so bad at speaking. I didn't even mention her. So Dawn is my grand sponsor, right? So when Meredith tells me stuff that I don't like, I call Dawn. And then she confirms it. And so it's like two people that tell me stuff I don't like. So then I'll call Meredith's husband, and he validates it for me. So anyways, thank you. So yes, I am a sponsor as well. I have sponsees. My sponsees have sponsees. That's how this program works. So I will start my story on the basic, where I came from. So I'm going to share with you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So basically, I was born on an Air Force base. I was a military kid, so I was born on an Air Force base in South Carolina, and before I was like a month old, I was already at a new place. And by the time I was, even like 3 years old, I had been to multiple different places. And I landed in Panama in South America when I was like three. And so I ended up going to preschool and, lower level school or whatever. And we lived there till I was about seven. So it was just kind of this like little bubble of a military base. My parents were DJs at the military base. So they had like every cool 80s CD that there was out. And I remember, you know, we lived in this, it was almost like what I would call a condo now. And it was just in this little cul-de-sac. And my parents would turn on the tunes on like Friday night, and we would kind of hang around the table. And when I was probably about seven is when I touched my first drink. So that was just, my dad had it on the table. I drank it. I did not like it, so I didn't drink it again. So anyways, we grew up there. We moved to Florida, and then we landed in Georgia back in 1990. So I was in third grade. So when I got there, I moved to Peachtree City. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Peachtree City. It's this little bubble town. They drive golf carts around like cars. Everyone waves at you and says hello, and they hold doors for you. And you're riding your bike and they're like, hey there, hey. And so I moved from like all these different places where people really didn't talk to you much. So it was just kind of weird when I moved there. And then when I went to school, the kids had already been going to school together for so long. So I got there, it was determined that I did not know how to read. So I was in third grade. I had manipulated my teachers to a point that they just kept passing me through school. So my mom was telling the teacher, look, I don't know how she's made it this far. She doesn't know how to read anything. But I was fluent in Spanish because we were in Panama. And so I had to, instead of after school going and hanging out with my friends, I had to go home and my mom had to teach me how to read. And I remember I can visualize kind of like us sitting there, her getting frustrated, me getting frustrated. But anyway, she ended up teaching me how to read. I went through elementary school, not really as an outsider, but I really didn't know a lot of people because they had all grown up together. I got into middle school and I was in sixth grade, and it was the first time I had ever done any drugs. I was an awesome skater. So I had like the quads, and we would go and skate every single Friday night, and my mom would take us and drop us off and leave us there. And at first we really would go and skate. But over time we met some older kids, and they did all these other extracurricular things. And so when I was in sixth grade, whatever age that is, younger than my youngest child, I did acid for the first time at the skating rink. It was the first time I had ever had this like out of body experience. I didn't really know if I liked it or not. I just know I laughed a lot. But I was also a child. So I did that, and then I kind of pondered around with some marijuana. I remember putting on sunglasses and just walking around at the football games. And I didn't do that for a long time, probably till I was like in eighth grade, because I had an older brother who was a drug addict, and he smoked weed, and I was like, I don't want to be anything like him, so I'll do acid instead. So by eighth grade, I was like, okay, you can't really do acid and go to school. It's really hard. So I'm going to stop and I'm going to just smoke weed. And so I picked up weed, and man, did I make all the friends in the world. I had so many friends when I started doing that. And my friends drank at the time, but I was like, I don't want to be like my brother. I'm just going to smoke weed. Got into high school, and when I got into high school, by then I had made a name for myself. I was kind of like, I was like the friend slut. I was like everyone's friend. So whoever you were, whatever group you were in, I fit in that group. Like I made myself fit, and I got what I wanted from that group, and then I go to the new group, get whatever I wanted from them, and so on. And then by the time I got into high school, you know, I was like the person you would want to get a ride to school with because I was smoking before school every day. And, you know, I would drink every once in a while, but I didn't like how once it was in my body, I had to kind of wait for it to go away because I like to consume a lot of it at one time. So I went through high school where we would just have kind of some weekends of drinking, but it was mainly just smoking, going to school. I worked, so by the time I was a junior in high school, my homeroom teacher was a work program teacher, and if you were in work program, you only had to go to school half a day. So I like finagled my way into work program, and I was working at an Outback Steakhouse, and I started, I worked at a tanning bed when I was 14, so I got a job because I needed money to support all my habits, and my parents would stop giving it to me. So I started working at the tanning bed on the weekends when I was 14, then I got the job at Outback when I was 16, so I would work open to close on the weekends at the tanning bed, and then Monday through Friday I was working at Outback. And then I got another job right after school for this industrial office. They needed someone to file papers for an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. So when I was a junior in high school, I had three jobs. It wasn't because my parents were broke or any of that. It was just I was hungry for the next thing. I wanted a brand new car, and my parents weren't going to buy it for me, so I got it for myself. I had to pay my own car insurance, it just anything I wanted to do, I was doing, you know. So when we would go, we did like spring break activities in Panama City and Daytona Beach, Florida, I look back on that, and I was the one paying for the hotel. I was the one doing all those things. So I had to keep all my jobs to keep that up. So anyways, I get through high school, and I focused more on work than I did school. So when I graduated, I was like, I'm going to take a year off, and then I'm going to go to college. And man, my friends went away to college, some of them, and some of them stayed. Some of them are still there. I moved to Atlanta, and when I moved, I was dating this guy. He was like the local Peachtree City drug dealer. He was like superb character. He taught me a lot of things, though, I do have to say. He taught me a lot of things that I did not know about myself. I thought I had hustle and drive and you know, I was a real go-getter, and he taught me very differently than that. So he sold cocaine, and that was what he did. And so when I started dating him, of course, I picked up that habit a little bit, and I had started to drink a little bit more, and I moved in with him because that's what all logical 18-year-olds do, is we move in with the drug-dealing boyfriend. And so I moved in with him, and we had this little apartment, and there were knocks on the door at 2 in the morning, there were knocks at the door at 6 in the morning, there was people threatening my life, there was people who were like, I'll clean your whole house for you for drugs. And I mean, my life was at its peak. I was 18 years old. So I lived with him. We ended up moving to Atlanta. And in between all of that, you know, it was just a big party. And that was when it was still fun. And so we got into an argument one time, and I decided I didn't want to live this life anymore. And I left and I moved home. I asked my parents to come home. And I got home and I got a job at Hooters in Fayetteville. And I was like, I'll show you, I can go make my own money. So yeah, at Hooters in Fayetteville. Now in Fayetteville, the Baptists picketed out front of Hooters. So when you went to work, they were like throwing stuff at you, and you're just like in your Hooters uniform, like, sorry. And Yeah, I mean, again, these are like the peak moments of my life. And so so I was at work one day and I wasn't feeling good. And this girl was like, dude, you're pregnant. And I was like, everyone says that when you get sick. So we went in the bathroom with a pregnancy test and I was pregnant. So now I was a pregnant Hooters girl, okay? They got me a shirt that said baby on board. It was a Hooters baby on board shirt. Like, yeah, yeah. I made more money in that shirt than I did in the damn Hooters uniform, though, I promise that. So, peak of my life, y'all. This is just, so anyways, so I decided that the drug dealing boyfriend, we were gonna change our life and we were gonna move in together and we were gonna get married and get a house and do all these things. And will you bring me my cup of water, please? And get a house and do all these things that normal people do that have a baby. And thank you. Sorry, y'all. And so, so I moved back in with him and I have my son. And my son was born very early. He was born with a congenital heart defect. I went into labor. I went to Chicago for a baby shower. And when I was there, I went into labor. And I had him, and he had to have open heart surgery, so I had to stay up there for a month until I was trained enough to be able to bring him home. I had to train with a nurse and learn how to do medication and oxygen and all those things. So I brought him home, and he was a super great baby. He started to get sick when he was close to about 5 months old, and I brought him into the hospital, and he had gotten some fluid on his lungs, and they went to do, it was logged as his 7th open heart surgery, and he didn't make it out from that. So I was 19 years old. I had to make the decision to take him off of life support, which was a super tough decision. I just remember looking back at it today, I had no idea the impact that this decision was gonna make on my life. So anyways, after that, I made that decision. I tried to make it work with the boyfriend, but he didn't wanna change, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing in life. I just kept going deeper in everything I was doing. But I was trying to put this mask up, you know, that I was okay from all these things. Anyways, I finally left him and I moved in with a roommate, and I picked up drinking was the new thing. I decided that cocaine was not working for me, so I totally stopped doing it. I went to one detox actually down the street from here. I went there and they said they don't detox anybody for cocaine. I went and took like a bunch of Xanax and showed back up and was like, okay, do you detox me off of this? And so I didn't know I needed help and I didn't know what else to do. And I was like, I'm gonna hustle the system, take Xanax and show up. And then they just gave me more when I was there. It was so messed up. So I was like, boy, I could come here more. And so anyway, so I went through that detox, and then, you know, I didn't do cocaine for 8 more years after that. I didn't touch it. It was clean. But my buddy alcohol kicked up. That's when me and Jägermeister met. Like, they used to have Jägermeister in this machine, and you push a button, and it keeps it really cold for you. And it's very, very easy just to hit the button and fill the cup. And so I picked up that habit. I was going to bars. I was doing all the things. I wanted to keep everybody in arm's length away from me because I had been so hurt by the one love that I knew that I had lost. I never wanted that to happen again. So I just, you know, I would meet someone, they wouldn't want to be in a relationship, and I'd be like, and then I'd leave. And I ended up meeting my ex-husband, Okay, that's a whole nother story. There's not enough time to talk about it. But I met him and I was married for 7 years. He's not a bad person. He was a shitty husband. He had a baby while I was married to him. We had two of our own kids. So I have two girls, they're 15 and 12. And they're at a homecoming football game this evening. And I hope they're not smoking weed or doing anything like that, because I'll kick their ass when I get them. And I will be checking them when I pick them up this evening. So anyways, I had my girls, and then I had got divorced. And the crazy thing is, looking back on all the things, you know, my ex-husband did serve a purpose in my life. And honestly, I really do have a lot of anger towards him. You can ask Meredith. But just like everyone who's been in my life, I can sit back and look at what they taught me. And you know, I was happily married until I wasn't. And so when I got divorced, I was working at a construction company as a workers' comp manager, and I was the drug and alcohol program manager. Yep. I was like, I know when the random drug tests are coming. And too, I was so messed up myself. I felt like this role was perfect for me, because when people reached out to me like, hey, I have a problem, I was right there with them with the problem. And I can identify with it, and I can talk to them, and I can talk to them about, you know, their family members and stuff. And I had my feet in and out of AA. I was working there, and I got divorced. And, you know, when I got divorced, I just saw another side of the world I knew nothing about, which is crazy because of the things I did before I got married. But I had so much chaos and hurt bottled up inside of me. But I was like so trying to be so hard on the exterior, so I couldn't let anyone know that this stuff was like heavy on me. And then the issue with my son, you know, I carried that for so long. I went to therapy, I took medication, but medication don't really work well when you're drinking with it. Well, I mean, when you're drinking with some of it, it was working well, but it wasn't doing what it was supposed to be doing. So I was doing all those things, but I wasn't honestly really trying to fix anything. So anyways, I had gone to my first rehab. I was drunk one night, and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I got on the phone, and I called a 1-800 number online. Yeah, don't do that. So I called this 1-800 number, and it led me to some treatment facility in California that we were going to do whale watching and horseback riding on the beach. I was like, that's it. That's where I'm going to go. And so it was at this place called Lake Elsinore, California. I got on a plane with a one-way ticket because my mom's like, we're done with you. We're only getting you one way. And I'm a Delta kid, so I fly free. So I was like, all right, whatever. And like, I was so deep in by the time I realized what I had done. I was like, told my work I wasn't going to be there for 30 days. I was loading a plane. I didn't know who I was going to meet, what I was going to do. I just knew I was going to get sober. And so I get on this plane, and I drank the entire flight, which California is a very long flight. And then I tried to play it off when I got there that I hadn't been drinking. And I show up, and this man has a sign with my name on it. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to get murdered in California. Like, what the hell have I done? But I'm like, nope, I'm going to get in the car with this guy. And he brings me to a detox facility. And this is when I had a good job and good insurance. So I went to this detox facility that did acupuncture and The stylists for the stars were there that cut your hair, and we were tie-dyeing shirts and making clay figures and stuff. And yeah, we had Netflix, we had video games, everything. Like, we were running it. The patients were running it. And it was Ativan every 2 hours. You didn't even have to ask. They were just giving it to you. And I was like, this is life. Again, it's like a peak moment in my life. I was like, it just keeps getting better. And they bring me to this mansion in the middle of the desert. And it's like a 30-bedroom mansion. And they just drop me off. And they were like, you go to class every day. You do some DBT, CBT, something learning. And I was like, can I please go home? I think I took this way too far. Like, I was being really dramatic. I'm totally fine. I'm sober now. But I only had the damn one-way plane ticket, and I was in the middle of nowhere. And one night, I did try to leave. I threw my bag over the gate, and the driveway was long as hell. And I got there, and there was tumbleweeds, and there was no cars or people, and I turned around and went back. In my sobriety, you know, I'm still friends with people that were in that house. And not every one of those people are sober. And of the women who came in and out of that house, six of them have passed away because of drugs or alcohol. And at the center as a whole, they did a thing out of 100 of the people who were there, 17 of them are gone. And that was within 2 years of us finishing that program. And that's what this disease is. It's fatal. And it took me a long time to learn that. But my most recent, I got a DUI walking down the side of the road, peak of my life. So I got a DUI walking down the side of the road, and I was unable to pass a drug screen for alcohol. I continued failing, and I went to jail for 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, and my final one was 60 days. And on that 60 days, I went to the judge, and I was like, look, I am a very productive member of the society. I have two jobs, and they need me. So can I just serve this time on the weekends? And so the judge is like, yeah, that's a great idea. So my alcoholic ass was like, yes, weekends. So if you take and divide 60 by 2, that's a lot of weekends, and that is a long time. Like, no one told me that. I was going to jail every weekend, like going to work, and on Friday I was like, see y'all on Monday, and I left and went to jail, and then showered and went, it's y'all. And I just thought it was a great idea. So on my last weekend, I went and I had calculated the amount of hours I had served, and I had 1 hour left. And I was like, I'm not doing 48 hours, I'm just gonna do one. So I'll sit here, you guys can do the paperwork, and then I'll leave. And I called and confirmed this with the lady, and I had about 45 days sober this time. And they told me, no, you gotta do the weekend or don't come and violate your probation. And I'm like, dude, I violated my probation while I'm here for 6 months. So I went and I got drunk at the jail. I was like, you know what? F you. I'll leave. I'll be back in 2 hours and turn myself in, and I'll just sleep all weekend after drinking. And that's not how it worked. So I like overly drank too much. I showed up back at the jail, and I had to get dropped off because I couldn't find my keys that were sitting on my dashboard at the house. And so my mom took me and dropped me off and was like, here you go, go, please go. And I took my purse in and I went in and I was like, I'm here for my jail weekend. And they were like, Miss Hurd, you need to go home and you just need to violate your probation for not showing up. I was like, oh, no. You guys want to book me? You're booking me tonight. So anyways, they rebooked me under a felony charge of crossing the guard line while intoxicated. So I did not only violate the damn probation anyways, because I didn't get that 1 hour served. I had been rearrested, rebooked into jail, and had to go to court again. But that time I had to go that Monday. And man, I still did not think I had too much of a problem. I just thought I had a problem getting caught. So anyways, I go in front of the judge and I'm like, how am I going to get out of this one? Because I've already talked him into all these damn weekends. I don't know what else he's got left under, you know. And I went and he's like, all right, 1 year, he's going to sentence me to 1 year in jail. He's like, but you have a problem. You need some help. And I was like, I'll go to sober living. Please let me go to sober living. Don't make me go to jail. And so the judge sentenced me to 6 months in sober living. So, but I had to go like immediately. So anyways, I found a sober living. And when I called the sober livings, I was still in a chaotic state of mind, but I wanted somewhere comfortable. And I wanted somewhere that was going to let me just pay them to be able to do whatever I wanted to do. So I found this place that had the cutest pictures online. And it was like all these amenities. It was a saltwater pool and all these things. It was like a bootleg ass apartment complex with a dingy pool. But I didn't know that on the website. So anyways, I go and I decided to go to sober living, and I remember calling Meredith back and saying, hey, I'm back. Can you sponsor me again? And she was like, dude, you're going to have to go to like some inpatient treatment. And I was like, huh, the judge said the same thing. So I'm going to sober living. And so she agreed to sponsor me based off of the fact that cohesively, the units around me decided they knew better for me than I knew for myself. And so anyways, I go to sober living and I get there and there's this cork board that's got chores on it. And this place is like $1,800 a month. It's more than double my mortgage. And so I'm like, who do we pay to do these things? Like, is it included in the fees? And so they give me this walkthrough and I go in my room and it's a half of a room, like in an apartment complex. And I was like, I have two beds? Like, am I allowed to have friends stay the night, you know? And I had half of an apartment closet. So, and the girl's stuff was all in my damn side. And I just remember like, okay, it's only 6 months. You can do anything. And I mean, I was 3 days in and I was like, F this. I'd rather go sit in jail and save the money. So anyways, the board was there and it had chores on it that you did weekly. Every Sunday I would do my chores. You had to make your bed every day. You had to get a sponsor. You had to work the steps. You had to know where you were in your steps. We met weekly and we kind of went around the room as a community, and the community had about 30 girls in it, 20 to 30 girls at any time. Most of them were like 18, and there was a few in the older age group. But anyways, you had to make your bed every single day. You had to be up by 8 a.m. And I'm like, dude, I'm paying you to stay here. So all this, we got to figure something else out. Because the doctor put me on this medication, and it makes me tired as hell. And I don't want to get up in the morning. And I don't want to do the dishes because they're not my dishes. And so I had a big problem with sober living for a while. And I started working the steps, and in those steps, I was able to identify the things in my life that were like not everything's about me all the time. But I truly felt that it was about me, and I didn't feel I was affecting anybody with this drinking. You know, I went to a meeting a couple weeks ago, and this guy shared, you know, his kids had never seen him drunk. He had his kids in sobriety, and they had never seen him drunk. And I don't have that luxury, and that breaks my heart for my kids. You know, not only are they from a divorced home, which I wasn't, my parents are still married. Sometimes I think neither one of them want to be, but that's nothing to do with me. But, you know, so I don't have that luxury. My kids saw me doing all these things. And so when I started working the steps, and they're on the wall up here, for anybody who's new, you know, at first I didn't know where I was at them. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I just knew that she told me to work the steps and work them honestly. So I did. I got to step 4, which everyone is like, oh, and that's where everyone quits or goes and gets drunk or whatever. I was literally clinging on to life. At this point, you know, it had started out like I just, you know, I didn't want to go to jail. And then it started out like, all right, well, if I got to be here, I'm just going to do these things to like, I'm uncovering some pretty cool stuff about myself. And really, I was not as good of a person as I thought I was. I got to the 4th step and I was like, oh, that's selfish. Like everything I do, I'm doing to myself. Like, and when I get drunk, it's just me, but that's not reality. When I got drunk, it affected everyone around me. And just the in and out of jail and the things I did to my mom and the people I love the most are the ones I hurt the most in my addiction. So I worked the steps. I went to a meeting every single day. So I was told to do 90 and 90 when I came here. And I was like, but y'all said do one day at a time. So do I need to do 90 and 90, or are we doing one day at a time? You're contradicting yourself. I don't believe anything you're saying now. And then I went to this meeting, and this lady picked up 27 years. And I was like, bullshit. There is no way. If you are an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, there's no way you've gone 27 straight years, not a single time, and haven't picked up a drink. I couldn't believe it. And so I continued to work my steps. I continued to go to meetings. And I was told it was all suggestions. You know, the only thing in my head that wasn't a suggestion was that damn going to sober living versus going to jail. I was like, I do not want to go back to jail. And I got about 4 months sober, and I thought that, you know, I had learned enough about myself, and I had some money in the bank, and, you know, I was going to be able to leave sober living with my head high. So instead of staying at sober living for the rest of the amount of money that I had, I was going to do the remaining 2 months in jail. I was going to go turn myself back in jail and save my money, because I was sentenced to the 6 months, and at 4 months, I was cured. Yeah. So I went to my sober living, and I was like, hey, guys, I'm just letting you know, you can go ahead and call the probation and let them know I'm going to turn myself in on Monday, and I'm going to finish my sentence out in jail. I'm sober. I can go sit in jail for 60 days. And like, y'all, this sounded so reasonable in my head. I called my mom and I was like, hey, just letting you know I'm gonna go to jail. But it's not because I'm in trouble. Like, I'm making the decision on my own. And so when I leave, I'll have $5,000 in the bank and I'll be such a winner. And I mean, y'all, what the hell? So my sober living's like, we're calling your sponsor now. And they call my mom, and everyone calls everyone, and they're like, we think it's not a good idea. And my mom's like, I'll give you money when you get out of there, or like, whatever you gotta do. So anyways, I decided, I was like, okay, fine, I'll stay. And what's crazy is I stayed there for a year and a half longer. I was sentenced to 6 months. I had 2 months left and I still stayed. And that's because I had started to uncover these things about myself that I never knew. You know, when I came into this program, I was absolutely broken to a point that I thought there was no way it was going to ever be repaired. I did not think, I thought I was always going to have to drink, no matter what. And it went from fun to where physically I had no other choice but to pick up and have a drink. And so when I left Sober Living, I involved my sponsor, my grand sponsor. I got this really awesome home group. I left with tools that I have been given over the time that I was there to learn how to live my life. So all that making the bed and that damn cork board with the list on it, every single Sunday, I still to this day do all my cleaning on Sundays. It's just how I was geared. I would love to say I make my bed every day, but my life is a little chaotic. I live in a camper on my parents' land right now. It's another story. So I don't have to make my, Jess, I know. So my bed kind of doesn't get unmade. I just get in it. But anyway, so these things taught me how to live my life. So today I live my life in a sense of I wake up in the morning and I pray. The steps, you know, when you go through the steps, the last step says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So when I got to that step, I didn't realize, like, they tricked me into the whole spiritual awakening thing. Like, literally tricked the shit out of me. Because when I got to that point, I was like, people would come to me with problems and I'd be like, did you pray about it? And they're like, what? Like, non-alcoholic people. They're like, what? Did I pray about it? And I'm like, yeah, you gotta pray about it. Ask for relief. Pray for the other person. And they're like, what the hell? Who are you? You know, my friend group has changed. Like I said at the beginning of this meeting, the support and love that I have in this room tonight, I never had that before I got sober. I had people who used me for stuff. I used them for stuff. It was whatever I can get from you. And I just didn't think, I didn't know that this whole other world existed. And the fact that I have not touched a single drink or drug in almost 4 years tomorrow is just like baffling to me. I don't want it. You know, if I hung on to the idea and I just came here just to not drink, I'd be miserable. Like, I come here because I get a spiritual fix. You know, I struggled with the God idea in the beginning. My higher power is God. They focus a lot on that word in these steps and everything, but the higher power is a suggestion. All this stuff is a suggestion, so you can create and visualize, and it's your thoughts of where you want to be with it. And it took me some time to get my idea of God right, because I grew up, you know, spiritually, like in church, and so, you know, when I came here, I just didn't know that's what I was going to be given, was this connection with God that, you know, I have stuff that happens in my life, and I literally can honestly 100% say I let it go. I practiced for a little while with a plastic plant, and I'd walk in and be like, give it to the plant, and it sounds dumb as hell, and I sound crazy. But it was like remembering how to visually get these things out of myself. And that's what this program taught me, brought me to God. I have a couple notes that my friend told me to write. So this is the main thing. So when I got here, someone said, if I can do it, you can do it. That's bullshit. Like, just because I can do it doesn't mean you can do it. My bottom and my broken may not be what yours is today. You may not be at your bottom, but I know that, like, if God does it for me and he has done it for me, he will do it for anyone. Because I was so far away from him and so far away. And he brought me back, and I'm back to him. And that's how I live my life today. I was willing to do whatever I had to do to get sober. And it absolutely has changed my life. So for anybody who's new, I promise you, keep coming back, keep listening. If you find a meeting that you don't like something at, sit down and figure out what you don't like about it and see if that's a reflection of you or the meeting. There's tons of meetings in the Atlanta area. Get a sponsor, work the steps. When you get through those steps, get sponsees. My sponsees, like, sponsor me more than I sponsor them. But it's just this whole community of life that I never knew existed, and I'm just so grateful, and I want to thank you all for listening to me tonight.
So good. Thank you so much, Kelly. That was awesome.